From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for April Bear. Today, Democrats in Lansing want to investigate the ties between people in Michigan and the January 6th Capitol insurrection.
It's critical that for the sake of our democracy, we understand the role that Michigan played in the lead up to the insurrection.
And with summer almost upon us, the environmental and human toll of heat waves.
Even if there wasn't a blackout, as many as 50,000 people in the city could be at risk of severe heat illness.
And a conversation with queer artist Backpack Durden.
I didn't think that I would be able to paint on something that was so reflective of my identity so soon. And I was like, well, I think we should just like show love.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I am Zoe Clark, sitting in today for April Bear. She is on a well-deserved vacation, back on Monday. It is less than a week before the official start of summer, and that, of course, is when extreme heat waves can have devastating effects.
Studies have shown that Michigan is definitely getting hotter. Also, what's really concerning is that while overall temperatures are warming by about 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit, nighttime temperatures are warming by even more.
That story coming up later in the hour. But first, Democrats in Lansing are calling for a bipartisan committee to investigate possible ties between people in Michigan and the U.S. Capitol insurrection on January 6th. They're calling for a bipartisan legislative committee that would be able to administer oaths, issue subpoenas, and examine records. Democratic leader in the state House, Representative Donna Lozinski, is here. Welcome, leader.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
So why this commission and why now?
Thank you for that question. We have seen over the last couple of weeks a few really important things happen at the national level. We saw that our congressional delegation here in Michigan, 9 of 14 members on a bipartisan basis, voted in support of Congress at our nation's capital, forming a bipartisan national commission to investigate the January 6th attack. It has widespread public support, but Congress failed to get that over the line. We've also had Senator Peters issue his and release his report looking at deficiencies and what happened in the lead up to and during the day on January 6th, again, for our nation's first incursion into our capital since the 1800s. When we look at Michigan and we look at April 30th, and we look at how there was a dress rehearsal, a very similar occurrence here in Michigan in the lead up to the insurrection at the nation's capital, it's critical that for the sake of our democracy, we understand the role that Michigan played in the lead up to the insurrection.
So when you're talking about April 30th, this is April 30th of 2020. Were you in the building that day?
I was. I was seated on the House floor, and it was COVID seating, so my seat had been rearranged. And I was probably 15 feet inside the swinging doors that separated us from very angry militia members.
And of course, what we know about Michigan law then is that was completely legal. So what is this tie between what happened on April 30th and possibly, you know, that influenced or there were the same folks? What is it that you're actually trying to figure out about the Michigan ties to D.C.?
Zoe, that is exactly the question that we're asking. What are the Michigan ties to the insurrection on January 6th? We know that that insurrection arose out of a continued propaganda campaign that the election that we had just gone through was false and invalid. We know, based on the most accurate audit and widespread audit that our state has ever conducted, that we had a safe and secure and accurate election here in Michigan. Yet we saw several factors. We saw the emboldening of militia members to have their presence felt in a capital here in Lansing. In fact, we saw the welcoming of those militia members by senators and folks here, right here in the Capitol. We saw them emboldened prior to the January 6th insurrection here in Michigan. We saw representatives, 15 Republican representatives, legislators, join a lawsuit to overturn the 2020 presidential election result. We saw folks, representatives, bring false electors to the Capitol here in Lansing when we were processing our electoral votes to facilitate the peaceful transfer of power. There are a lot of questions about how all of these occurrences, all of these events, did they play a role in inciting, in instigating, in helping people understand how to execute an insurrection on our capitals, at our nation's capital?
We got in touch, of course, with the Republican leaders in Lansing. We heard from the Republican Speaker of the House's spokesperson. He said, and I quote, "The only reason a state legislator would be the one to investigate what happened 1,000 miles away at the literal seat of another government is for political grandstanding. It's that or either Leader Leszczynski trusts Merrick Garland even less than Mitch McConnell did." He adds, "Either way, the speaker is not interested in this stunt." Are you disappointed to hear that?
This resolution was read in on the House floor yesterday. It was gaveled to a committee. We know that when the Joint Committee for the Flint water investigation was first proposed, there was a lot of pushback. There was a lot of quotes similar to that. This is a political stunt. This is a partisan game. We know that that was not true, and that the commission did form, and its results and reports were critical to our understanding of how not to have another water crisis like that occur in our state again. What we are asking and what our resolution proposes to look at is the specific role that Michiganders here in Michigan, things that happened at our Capitol, led up to and participated, incited, or instigated an event that ended up happening at our nation's capital. But what role did we play in that as elected leaders, welcoming militia members, encouraging militia members, perpetuating false theories of the outcome of the election, bringing false electors to our capital? These are all things that happened here in Lansing at our capital. And we need to understand those and reckon with those for the protection of our democratic institutions from now and moving forward.
A spokesperson for Senate Republicans says, quote, "It would seem that any investigation of criminal wrongdoing would be best handled by the relevant law enforcement." Is that something that this should just go to law enforcement rather than necessarily a legislative committee? What more can you do?
And again, thank you for that question. And I'll again reflect on the Flint water crisis. We learned so much from that commission about procedural errors, about how legislators, staff, and the public interact, and how that impacts decision-making going forward, how decisions were made, what was encouraged and discouraged. It is through that same lens that we must look at our democracy. It is with that same lens that we must look at the language of leadership, propaganda that was put in place. We must look at our Michigan ties that led to the insurrection of our nation's capital with our lens focused squarely on Lansing, focused squarely on the events here, focused squarely on the decisions and the actions that were taken that instigated, incited, that helped create the environment where an insurrection of our nation's capital could happen.
So you noted this is a concurrent resolution. It was referred to the Government Operations Committee. That is a committee, as Beth LeBlanc noted in the Detroit News, is often used by House leadership for House bills that have slim chances of moving through the legislative process, LeBlanc writes. It sounds like maybe you're hopeful that, much like the Flint Commission, this is actually going to happen. But what does it say, the fact that this went straight to government? Ops.
So it's interesting, and you are absolutely correct. Government ops has a very storied history. It is either used often to shove things through very quickly, or to slow things down. What I am encouraging my colleagues on the other side of the aisle to do is to take a very serious look at this proposal. Now that the resolution has been introduced, the public is able to see it, to understand it, and I am very hopeful that there will be growing voice and growing calls from Michiganders to take this issue seriously, to take our democracy seriously, and to have a committee hearing and the creation of this commission.
Have you had any conversations with Republicans that have made you believe, have led you to believe that they might?
Again, we saw at the federal level here in Michigan, a bipartisan support of a commission of this type to investigate what happened in Washington, D.C., supported on a bipartisan basis. We just introduced this resolution yesterday. We're beginning the conversations, and I would encourage all of my colleagues to take a very serious look at this resolution and to consider our democracy, our democratic institutions, and for us to understand the threats that were posed there and what we can do and how we can understand those threats so that we secure our democracy for generations to come.
Democratic leader in the State House, Representative Donna Luzinski, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Zoe.
Sixty 60% of Michiganders age 16 and up have now received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. And the infection rate is the lowest it's been in a year. The state was set to end COVID mandates for everyone in Michigan, both vaccinated and unvaccinated, on July 1st. But earlier today, Governor Gretchen Whitmer said the restrictions might be done sooner than that.
And to all the Michiganers who've gotten their shot, we're looking forward at the next rollback. In the coming days. And it's scheduled for July 1st, but I think you should stay tuned.
As the governor said, we'll just have to stay tuned. Still to come, a muralist on making their artistic mark using many mediums.
It's intimidating at first, and then I think It's a chance to make a concept larger and reach more people, and then it turns into fun instead of scary. So I like that more than anything.
That's coming up next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for April Bear. Talk about someone who's put a mark on the city. There's Detroit versus everybody on Russell Street, the Brush Street Viaduct, LGBT Detroit, Brilliant Detroit on Hazelwood. These are some of the many places across the Motor City where you'll find murals by Backpack Durden. And it's not just murals Backpack calls their specialty. They've been known to style hair, ink, tattoos, illustrate, and most recently co-founded a printing press. Master of all, Backpack is one of those people whose work speaks for itself. And then you meet them and see there's so much more to their story. Backpack recently spoke with April Bear from their home in Detroit. Here's their conversation.
Backpack Durden, welcome to Stateside.
Hello.
What do you remember about being a young artist? Could you just take us back and tell us about some first favorite things to create?
Favorite things. I used to just like make stuff really tiny and then sell it back to my parents. Like, I used to make these pillows made out of construction paper stapled together, and then I would draw and write their favorite things on it and stuff it with tissue and then sell it to them. And they paid for it, so that was appreciated.
You know, it's not every artist that can get that successful business plan, especially right? Not from the early days. That's awesome. What did they, like, did they open them up then, or did they just know that you had stuffed them with goodness?
I had to sell them on it. I had to sell them on the idea of what it was, and that you just had to let it be because it was art, you know? But other than that, like, I used to draw all the time and draw really small, and then everything tiny would make something bigger, and it didn't make sense until it was completely done.
Were you in a place where there were a lot of other creatives around you? Did you know a lot of artists growing up?
I didn't know people to be artists. I knew people to be people, I guess, and they had creative pursuits. My grandmother was a seamstress and also a world traveler, and she would collect a bunch of art and statues and pretty much everything from all over the world. So I was surrounded by that and surrounded by everything she made and made us wear. And my mom was an illustrator and a painter, but went toward video production and then ended up not doing most of that. And my brother was an illustrator as well.
There's an interesting story, I feel, for every muralist as we find out how the imagination grew into larger and larger spaces. Could you talk a little bit about how your practice moved from, you know, painting and forms of illustration into mural art?
Well, this is a fun story. People would tell me that I should paint because I was always drawing really, really small detail. But no one told me why I should paint. And it wasn't until, I would say, I started working with Sydney James, assisting her on murals, and just learning all of her techniques and how she scales up her illustrations and her paintings. And then I accidentally started painting with oils via
accidentally.
My partner at the time was an oil painter, and she said that I could use the paints if I wanted to. And I was like, I don't want to paint. And then I was bored enough one day, and I did it, and it made sense. But they both started at the same time, painting studio and painting mural. It was like, I would say a year or two difference between when I started painting for myself and painting for other people. And then a year after I started oil painting, or within the same year, I started painting my own murals.
Nice. Backpack, you do a fair number of self-portraits. Some of them are solo. I am really, really captivated by one that I think is a more recent work where you've sort of inserted yourself across a couple of geometric planes. The portrait's called Not This Again. Could you tell us a little bit about that one?
I was making a shift from painting other people to painting myself more. And I don't actually really like painting myself, honestly, but I'm the narrative that I know the best and the most, and that I feel I have the privilege to tell the story of. And in this instance, it was basically a mental health crisis and falling into depression constantly, like the cyclical nature of falling into depression. So that one was that one.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the physical posture in that one?
Okay. I'm falling through the triangle because it's a quick fall into depression and a long climb out of it. So sometimes you just get blindsided, and that whole motion is, you get blindsided and you fall into it. You're going from a spectrum of colors into a monochromatic black and white space. And yeah, there's a shift.
You've also worked to highlight some issues in neurodiversity and mental health. That self-portrait, Not This Again, is a perfect example. you know, sort of keeping that opening that conversation and keeping it open. And it's something that the culture often, it feels like our culture would often like to sideline or just treat as a niche issue.
Right.
Why is this something that's been important for you to take on?
It's important because I can't talk about it. It's so hard to talk about, especially because everyone's experience is different. So through therapy nowadays, I'm learning to understand that the visual medium is my language, and that's how I can explain to other people better than my words can, because they fail me oftentimes. So I would try and use an analogy to explain how I'm feeling, and it wasn't being understood. And so I made it into a visual, like the one with the spinning top. That one is a direct reflection of, I think, going into an anxiety attack. Now I've got some distance from it.
We should mention that the painting with the spinning top is called Control. People can see it at Backpack's website. You also have done a portrait of yourself with your partner, Syra Dardis. It's beautiful and joyful.
Thank you.
What does it mean to you to portray your own self and your public work in these ways?
I often try to block my face. And others, unless it's absolutely necessary to have someone's face in it. But in our instance for this mural, Constellation in Winter, it's on the LGBT Center, which was like, I didn't think that I would be able to paint on something that was so reflective of my identity so soon, I guess. And I was like, well, I think we should just, like, show love in the most basic form, in a non-gendered way, like, as a photograph, even. And it worked out, I think.
Can I take a sec to describe it?
Yeah.
You've chosen to portray you and Syra as, I mean, what we really see is just your hands clasping. And you're in a posture that's, you know, you're sitting very close together. It's just very intimate and very everyday, you know, just kind of something that you might see, you know, any couple do. And yet it's so relaxed and so kind of not remarkable in that way, which is, it's kind of what makes it wonderful for me.
I agree. Yeah. Not remarkable is beautiful.
If you're just joining us today, I'm talking with Backpack Durden, muralist, illustrator. I don't know what to say. Stylist of the body? I mean, your canvases are so many and so varied. But working in Detroit, all over Detroit and its people. You know, for folks who didn't catch the introduction, and I was using your pronouns, you identify as trans in a place and a time where trans visibility is pretty minimal, even today. And even in some art spaces, I wanted to ask if there are some ways in which your creative practice has included yourself.
Well, for a long time, I was hiding myself. And it didn't do me any service, or it did the art a disservice as well. So leaning into my own narrative as a trans person and a multi-dimensional, intersectional human being who experiences the world in this certain way, I felt like it was important to be visible but safe, to speak to the things from my perspective and share them in a way that I felt was safe for me. And I feel like doing that, I'm being visible for other people down the line, like people have for me in different ways. So,
is there anything you can tell us about the ways that you do that, that you ensure your own safety?
This is hard. Sometimes I don't put where I am when I'm painting a mural unless I can be off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's in a highly populated area, I'll stay where I'm at or make sure that there's people checking in on me. And then oftentimes I get misgendered and threatened and stuff, and I just roll with it because it's not the place to educate people if it's on a level of conflict. So just gotta like watch behind me while I'm painting, I guess.
Yeah. Eyes open 360 yeah. degrees 24/7.
Head on a swivel.
Yeah. You worked on starting something called the Starving Artist Movement. Could you explain what it's about and what you're up to these days with it?
Starving Artist is my it's my business, my LLC, where the checks get made to. And under that, we started Paper Street. So with Starving Artist, I do a lot of production work in terms of around art, which is everything. And then I also do a lot of documentation for folks and for myself. And the idea is to uplift artists where they're at, including myself, including my partner, including my friends, and get us to where we need to be without the necessity of elite structures that have been placed upon us. So
would it be right to describe it as a design and creative services operation?
See,
for
that's why I need
artists?
People like you around.
Right.
You're like, right. Bring it down.
Yeah. Backpack, Detroit's creative scene has gotten just this incredible boost of national and global attention. And there are creators coming to Detroit these days from all over the place. And there's plenty of middle-class white people coming. But there are also people of color coming to Detroit who want to take part in the community and who want to take part in the energy. Do you think at all about the balance? I mean, it's great to have a lot of resources and a lot of money pouring into the city.
Right.
But it has at times led to people who have been doing things here the hard way of their whole lives getting left out. How do you think about that balance?
There's a way to find a balance, but oftentimes people want to move too fast and go the route that they know to work instead of considering the folks that like are from here that do get left behind. I think the balance comes down to humility and listening. Yeah. Humanity?
Yeah.
Empathy? Yeah. I don't know. There's like, I could go on about like how not having the education that's been, you know, held over our heads has held me back. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't care. I'm gonna keep making art. I'm keep being a good person. I'm gonna keep being like building community with folks that want to build community and be in right relation to the things that are shaking out in the world. And if you miss it, then that's your fault, as opposed to beating myself up about being looked over all the time.
That actually brings me around to something that I wanted to ask you about. You know, you mentioned that you've been drawing forever.
Yeah.
When I look at your murals, I just see a mastery of light and image that really is unique. Sydney James has that too. You know, I see that in her yeah. work. But you have such a painterly grasp on that. Is there anything that you think really was formative to you in developing that visual style, especially when you're painting people?
Oh, cinema. I am inspired by cinema and the fact that you can capture so much without saying a lot and with saying almost too much. But like the cross section between film and cinema and let's say Baroque art, and then that fits within a larger bubble of identity and telling that story. So I want to make sure that the light is telling a story, the subjects are telling a story, the color is telling a story. Like, everything is considered whenever I make things.
Backpack, I know you're working on a mural this summer. Is it anything that you can tell us about?
I'm currently working on a mural, and it's in conjunction with Black Lives Matter Detroit. And then there's some other murals that I can't talk about. And I also have a show later in the year with Playground Detroit.
Well, sign me up. Cannot wait. And Backpack, it is such a pleasure talking to you. We kind of want to just know about everything you're working on all the time. So please do keep in touch. We'd love to have you back sometime.
Of course.
Backpack Durden, see their work all over Detroit. Like, literally, all over Detroit.
Coming up, we'll hear about a climate crisis headed for Metro Detroit, and the effects could be comparable to Hurricane Katrina.
Last summer, we had the remnants of a tropical storm move through the city, which took out power to tens of thousands of people.
That story coming up. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for April Bear. Imagine in a few weeks, it's summer, and you're sitting at home in the middle of the afternoon because it is too hot to go outside. Inside, your thermostat hasn't gone down below 87 degrees since yesterday. And because of a down power line, your electricity is out. And despite what customer service says, you have no idea when it's coming back on. So you're home and overheating indefinitely. This is the case for many people across Michigan, but especially in Metro Detroit, where extreme heat waves and power outages are expected in the coming months. Brian Allnut is a writer and contributor and editor at Planet Detroit. His latest article is about research showing that this summer could lead to a weather disaster bigger than Hurricane Katrina. Welcome back to Stateside, Brian.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So I want to start with your piece and the study that you write about. It's found in the Journal of Environmental Science and Technology, and it's looking at the dangers and risk factors here. What did the study find?
Well, it's really concerning. The study found that in Detroit specifically, about two-thirds of the city could be at risk of a heat-related illness if there was a simultaneous blackout and heat wave. And it's really important to note that this is based not on the kind of scenario we might see with global heating, but actually on a historical heat wave, the 1994 Detroit heat wave, that many people would be at risk. And even if there wasn't a blackout, as many as 50,000 people in the city could be at risk of severe heat illness.
Two-thirds. How is it that we have gotten to that point? I mean, it's 2021. How is it that we can have an entire city where two-thirds could be at danger?
Yeah, there are a lot of risk factors that seem to be especially impacting Detroit. And so primary ones are the lack of central air in the city, but also a lot of people don't even have window units. Also, the large number of single-family homes, which these sorts of buildings, they're less able to stay cool under extreme temperatures than multi-unit homes are.
You also talk in your piece about how the fact that Detroit is especially vulnerable to power failures. Apparently, Michigan ranks fourth nationally for the number of hours each year that a customer on average is without power.
Yeah, it's a pretty major issue here. And then also in the DTE coverage area specifically, that utility is the worst performing in terms of total number of hours without power of any investor-owned utility in the state. Some of the things that are contributing to this as well, during the summer, seeing large numbers of power outages, which the study found was a problem countrywide, are extreme weather events that tend to happen during the summer. So things like thunderstorms, but also hurricanes and fires, which we might think that we don't really experience here in Michigan. But increasingly, those are things that we're seeing. So there have been fires in the state recently. And then also last summer, we had the remnants of a tropical storm move through the state, which took out power to tens of thousands of people.
Brian, how is climate change affecting all of this in addition to everything else that you've said?
Yeah, studies have shown that Michigan is definitely getting hotter. Also, what's really concerning is that while overall temperatures are warming by about 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit, nighttime temperatures are warming by even more. And that's when you see a lot of fatalities during a heat wave, is when people aren't able to cool down overnight and they kind of don't get a break from the heat. So that can make some of these heat waves particularly dangerous.
This is Stateside. We're speaking with Brian Allnutt, and I want to bring in Dr. Jalon White Newsom. She is CEO and founder of Empowering a Green Environment and Economy. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much.
Talk to me a little bit about the work that you do.
Sure. So I am an environmental consultant, and my practice is to transform communities by using people-centered solutions. And a lot of that work is focused on looking at the institutions and the practices and policies that don't serve certain communities in the best way. So how do we make sure that everybody is able to live in a healthy, safe, and productive environment, particularly low-income communities and communities of color, and those that are impacted negatively by climate change?
So when you hear what Brian has to say, none of this must be surprising or news to you.
It definitely hits home. I mean, I'm a native Detroiter, and part of my research got started around climate change and extreme heat, particularly as related to taking care of my grandparents. And they lived on the west side of Detroit for over 50 years. And what I started seeing with them is that the weather got hotter, their bodies weren't able to adjust because they were, one, dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's. But the fact that some of the medications that they were on were actually, you know, kind of teasing their body that they thought they were cooler than what they were. So they were actually suffering from heat stress. And so when I started to kind of reach out and figure out what resources are in the city to help with my grandparents and other seniors that were dealing with similar challenges, there wasn't a lot of education. There wasn't a lot of emphasis on it. And kind of climate change was, particularly around heat, was kind of like this invisible threat that wasn't getting any attention.
Brian, you and our producer, Aaron Allen, spoke to Michelle Jones, who's experienced this just last summer in her Highland Park home.
We had just went shopping that week, actually. And so we had quite a bit of food in the refrigerator. I was able to get, we took most of the food out the freezer to my other daughter's house, but we lost close to $200 worth of food in the refrigerator. We have neighbors who are disabled, use wheelchairs that have to be charged, and they weren't able to charge their wheelchairs. So, yes, it's a big issue.
So, I mean, doctor, these are things that we, you know, might just think about being overheated, but it's so much more than that.
It is so much more. And I tell you, in addition to communities and people losing food because they can't refrigerate, think about some of the, particularly our elderly folks that, and other folks that are on medications that need to be refrigerated, and they lose that. But then, particularly in this time of COVID, there are some communities that need electricity to run water pumps. And so the lack of water access, again, contributes to the public health issues and even proper hydration, which is so critical when it's hot outside. But then also, if you don't have electricity, you know, you can't do homeschooling, or you can't have virtual visits with doctors. And of course, not having central air, not having an AC unit in your window, and sometimes not being able to even open up your windows because either they're painted shut or you're scared for security reasons to open your windows in the community you live, that all contributes to heat stress and heat stroke, and sometimes in certain cases, unfortunately, heat-related deaths.
I want to listen to Michelle Jones again, who Brian, you and our producer, Aaron Allen, spoke with. She talked about some of the barriers, like you said, of just getting central air.
Our house is 100 years old this year. And so, no, it's not energy efficient, quote unquote. We do not have central air. To put in central air would be a major financial burden, because ductwork would have to be done in this house in order to do that. So we are reliant on being able to use fans, window air conditioners. We're not the only ones. There are quite a few neighbors here who are living in older homes, and they don't have heat efficiency.
And doctor, one of the things that you've talked a little bit about earlier is, what do we do when we actually just, you know, we can get electricity, we can't pay for the electricity. And this is an issue with DTE Energy, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, when you talk about this whole concept of energy poverty, it's real. We have families that are trying to make the decision whether to buy bread or pay their electricity bill. And you have families that are paying, you know, ridiculous amounts of money, more than 6% of their income, to an energy company. And so when you have folks that are on a fixed income or have limited income, that becomes a real challenge. So, I mean, what do we do in that situation? Well, I think there's a couple of things. The first is that we need to really look at, you know, I would say the first thing is making sure that our energy sources are cleaner. And that impacts not only climate change, but also the health of communities that are dependent on these energy sources. So when I say cleaner, you know, I think DTE's energy mix right now relies on over 40% of coal-fired powered energy generating units, whereas we need to be switching to cleaner forms. And those cleaner forms do a couple of things. One, you know, it actually increases reliability. And two, it reduces the emissions in the air that are driving these higher temperatures and these temperature extremes that we're seeing. I would say the second piece is really looking at planning. You know, it is no surprise to me that certain communities, oftentimes low-income communities, communities of color, are most often at risk related to climate events, whether it's heat or cold. So how do we begin to prioritize planning to make sure that these communities have what some folks are creating, resilience hubs? So basically spaces and places that are centered in the community that offer generators for secondary electricity, that offer refrigerators to cool medicine, and things of that nature. So how do we begin to put these hubs in communities so folks are not at risk, particularly when there are multiple days of blackouts? And then I think the last thing is just really prioritizing, again, those peoples and communities that are highest at risk. So our elders, our seniors, you know, making sure that when there is an outage, and, you know, that they are prioritized in terms of getting energy back up, or there are some other adaptation mechanisms that folks can use temporarily, whether it be a generator or making sure that they're taken to a place where they can get cooled, just to, again, maintain their health. So there's a lot of things that can be done, both by, I believe, DTE Energy, as well as the city and planning and health agencies.
Well, Brian, in your article, you mentioned some alternative ways that people, you know, try to keep cool in these conditions that cities are trying to do, like cooling stations. And you talk about that Detroit's police precincts are open as cooling stations, and that's something that folks talk about. But, you know, there are actually like real potential problems there, right?
Yeah. And that's sort of the backup plan that's been put forward by the city. And part of the reason that that's been put forward is because police stations have backup power, which cooling centers don't necessarily have backup power and aren't required to have backup power. But people have also challenged the very notion of doing that because of all these high profile examples of police violence that we've had in the last few years, that many residents might not feel safe going to a police station for cooling. So definitely more needs to be done to shore up this cooling infrastructure, whether it's resilience hubs, more cooling centers, making sure these cooling centers have backup power, Because as it stands right now, even with all these cooling centers functioning, they can only accommodate about 1% to 2% of the city.
Doctor, right now, is this a priority for those who are meant to fix problems like this? Is this top of mind?
That is such a hard question, because I tell you, I started working in this area of climate change and extreme heat 10 years ago, and we are still having the same conversation right now. So I think because of the number and the frequency and the intensity of extreme weather that we're experiencing, it becomes a priority, you know, while it's happening. But I feel like it needs to be a priority even while we're not in a heat wave, because that's where the planning needs to begin. And I don't feel like it's been a priority for particularly the agencies that, you know, have a huge responsibility for protecting Detroiters and particularly our most vulnerable communities. So I think we can always do better. And part of that is making sure that as these agencies and entities and decision makers that are responsible, that we pay tax dollars to take care of these communities, that they're actually engaging with the communities that are most impacted. So you're developing solutions that make sense, that use the social infrastructure that's already in place, and that will actually protect the people.
Is there some concern, too, that in so many instances, it feels like, you know, governments, whether it's, you know, small or statewide or city governments, you wait till there's a huge crisis or a huge incident, something awful, to fix the problems. Is there a sense like that that's what's going to have to take to, I mean, you've been doing this for 10 years, that there's going to have to be some sort of horrible incident for folks to finally get the message that this is something that needs to take precedent?
You know, I feel like we have already had those seminal events, and we've already had these multiple crises around climate change and extreme heat. I was actually in Chicago during the 1995 heat wave. I was actually in Paris during the Parisian heat wave in 2003. And I got married here in Detroit during the blackout of August 2003. So I think we have had enough crises and enough deaths to understand that this is not something that we can, you know, not pay attention to. My hope is that from our experiences in these crises, plus the other layers of vulnerability that our communities are experiencing, whether it be with COVID, whether it be with mental health, whether it be with the economy, that we begin to multi-solve for all these issues so nothing gets a short shrift. We cannot just afford to try and tackle things in silos, which I think keeps us at a disadvantage, because we as people, we don't live in silos. We are experiencing all these different stressors, and all those different stressors and factors, whether they be physical, mental, health, economic, they all contribute to the vulnerability of the environment that we're living in. And so my hope is that, you know, again, the evidence is there that there are certain people that get the short end of the stick in any situation. So how do we begin to shore up an infrastructure that takes care of those that are more at risk, that are more vulnerable? And, you know, again, we don't need any more proof points. We have enough of them.
That's Dr. Jalon White Newsom. She is the CEO and founder of Empowering a Green Environment and Economy. We've also been speaking with Brian Allnut. He is a writer and contributing editor at Planet Detroit. His latest article is about research showing that this summer could lead to a weather disaster in Detroit bigger than Hurricane Katrina. Thank you both for joining us on Stateside today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that's the show for today. Stateside is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Chantel Phillips and Lucas Pollock. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark. Thanks so much for listening.